loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. First, Brexit Secretary David Davis resigned yesterday, and Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson resigned today over what they say is a poor plan on Brexit. What will this mean for the imploding government of Conservative Party leader Theresa May? We'll discuss what this means for the UK and Europe more broadly. Then, mass protests in Haiti erupted and have been ongoing for several days. Protesters rose up in the capital of Port-au-Prince over the government's attempts to raise fuel prices and impose new austerity measures. And then our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garofa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, privacy, civil rights, and civil liberties. Today's tech tip is about which browser to use. Stay tuned to hear it.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, an on-call judge in Brazil yesterday ruled that former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva should be released immediately from prison. But the head of the federal court stepped in and overruled that decision, saying that Lula was duly convicted of corruption and must remain incarcerated. Next, charges were dropped on Friday against the last remaining 39 people arrested for participating in the rally against Donald Trump on Inauguration Day. Most of the 230 people initially arrested were charged with felony rioting, but the government simply could not prove its case. Then we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Today we talk about Mississippi Freedom School. And then reports are circulating that the Kurdish YPG and the Syrian government are in talks to improve relations and cooperate over the future of the country. Meanwhile, heavy fighting in the southern province of Daraa has subsided as a ceasefire takes effect. And finally, Dawn Sturgis, who was allegedly poisoned in the UK city of Salisbury, has died. The media and many politicians have jumped on the case to revive the Novichok anti-Russia narrative that has been falling apart after Yulia and Sergei Skripal survived their alleged poisoning earlier this year. And in other headlines, newly re-elected Turkish President Erdogan was sworn into office for a new term today. As a result of controversial constitutional reform, Erdogan now has expanded powers to rule by decree and make important judicial appointments, as well as to dismiss parliament. President Erdogan now must face a growing economic crisis in the country, as well as ongoing regional turmoil. A monumental diplomatic breakthrough was reached today between longtime arch-enemies Ethiopia and Eritrea. The president of Eritrea and the prime minister of Ethiopia signed a joint declaration of peace and friendship that declared an end to the state of war between the two countries. Eritrea fought a bloody war of independence from Ethiopia in the early 1990s, and border disputes and other extreme diplomatic tensions had characterized their relations ever since. The deadline is coming up tomorrow for the government to reunite all children under five who were separated from their parents at the border. The ACLU reports that this looks very unlikely, projecting that of the list of 102 children under the age of five who were taken from their parents, fewer than half will likely be reunited by tomorrow. There were more than 2,000 children of all ages separated from their parents by the administration, and those five or older must be reunited by July 26th. President Trump will announce at 9 o'clock p.m. this evening who his nominee is for the vacant seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. There are several federal judges whose names have been in discussion. The open seat comes from the surprising departure of Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was widely regarded as the swing seat on the court. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the U.K. There's a major shakeup in the government in the U.K. Yesterday, Brexit Secretary David Davis and his deputy resigned because of Conservative Party anger over the policy of negotiating a soft landing or a soft Brexit, whereby the UK would still maintain close ties to the EU after Brexit. And this morning, Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson abruptly resigned because he opposed the policy. But perhaps this was an attempt by Boris Johnson to position himself to replace Theresa May as the leader of the Conservative Party. We're joined from London by Alex Gordon. Alex is the former president of the National Union of Rail, Maritime, and Transport Workers Union. Alex Gordon, welcome back.
How are you doing?
Good. A lot of news there in the UK. Your government seems to be tumbling. Of course, people in Britain may be also paying attention to the World Cup. Anyway, big news from where you are.
Yeah, it's very exciting. We're viewing this through the perspective of a very hot, sunny July in London and in Britain, with England proceeding to the semi-finals of the Football World Cup. That's real football, you know, not which you call soccer. But we're very excited. We're very upbeat. And just to cap it all, in the last 24 hours, the Conservative Party in Britain appears to be embarking on its kind of act of ritual self-immolation. And it's for those of us, such as myself, who have campaigned for many years for Britain to leave the European Union in order to implement socialist policies, to take back control of our economy in the interests of the many, not the few. This is a moment that we've been waiting for. We did get rid of one Conservative Prime Minister and his Chancellor in 2016 when we voted to leave the European Union. We voted for Brexit. And David Cameron, the then Conservative Prime Minister, departed more or less the next day. And the Tory Party, you know, the oldest, most successful party of the ruling class in the world, reassembled its men in grey suits and chose a new figurehead, Theresa May, who has been leading them on a merry dance for the last 2 years. And in the last 48 hours, that has now reached a crisis point. So, yes, we've had the resignation, first of all, of the Secretary of State responsible for leaving the European Union, for Britain leaving the European Union, David Davis. And in the last few hours, we've had the resignation of the British Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, a man who, you know, is his trademark is his political ambition. So this is somebody who's waited and waited and waited until he thought the moment was right to stick a dagger in the Prime Minister. And the Tory party are very, very good at internal coups. So what's going to be playing out now over the next hours and days is going to be a sort of Shakespearean tragedy where we'll see who turns up eventually as the leader of the Conservative Party. But for us, people in this country struggling with austerity and the policies of cutting public spending, which this government has made its trademark, this brings about a real possibility of an early general election and the election of a Labour government with a socialist leadership. There's got to be a lot of slips and possible pitfalls between now and that potential outcome, but it's a moment of potential great opportunity that we're looking at the moment.
We're speaking with Alex Gordon from London. Alex is former president of the National Union of Rail, Maritime, and Transport Workers. Alex, I have to ask you too about Boris Johnson. He was the unlikeliest of foreign secretaries. He would be the unlikeliest of prime ministers. But do you think that this allows him or affords him the opportunity to actually become prime minister? Can someone like Boris Johnson take over the Conservative Party? And do you think this is a crisis for Britain? Is it a crisis just for the Tories? And does this in any way jeopardize Brexit?
Well it's certainly a crisis for the Tories. And there is a possibility of Johnson becoming the next Tory leader. He's certainly invested an awful lot of time in cultivating supporters in the backbenches of the Tory party, who no doubt he's currently ringing round to promise jobs under his future administration, potential administration. But I don't think there's very much chance of Boris Johnson becoming Prime Minister. He would not be able to command the support of the country in a general election. He's a figure of, he's an extraordinary figure, highly intelligent, very witty, extremely right-wing, and he would rip the mask off the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, the British Conservative Party, which has been so carefully constructed in the last 10 to 15 years by previous Conservative leaders who have sought to position the party as being a socially liberal, centre-ground party in order to triangulate and win the votes of as they see it, the centre-ground. The reality is that Johnson is somebody who's extremely divisive, and there could be no better leader of the Conservative Party for the Labour Party to take on in a general election. So from our point of view, this crisis that's going on in the Tory party at the moment is polarizing politics in Britain, which are already very polarized, but it's creating a dynamic which is leading towards an early general election. If there is a general election, there is going to be an overwhelming demand, I believe, from British voters for a change of government to sweep out the Conservatives and to bring in a Labour government, which is the main party of the opposition, and which is led by certainly the most left-wing leader that it's had for many, many decades in Jeremy Corbyn.
It would be really quite remarkable for Jeremy Corbyn to become the Prime Minister. I can remember, Alex, 15 years ago, I was the central organizer of a demonstration against the Iraq war here in Washington. It was about 500,000 people. And Jeremy Corbyn was here. He came here. He spoke at our demonstration. He was one of the rare political figures who, you know, if you go back over the decades, his message now is the same as his message the decade before and the decade before that and the decade before that. And as a consequence, we see all of these sort of profoundly shifting politics on the global stage, but especially within the heartlands of the United States and within the UK, where there is this huge yearning for change. But even with that said, Bernie Sanders, if he were to become president of the United States, would still be far to the right of Jeremy Corbyn should he become the prime minister of the UK.
Well, I mean, I think the points that you've made about Jeremy's lifelong commitment to the politics of peace, nuclear disarmament, and anti-imperialism and siding with the victims of imperialism is absolutely correct. It is important for listeners to your program, observers of British politics in America, to understand that Corbyn is not a classical Labour politician or a classical Social Democrat. He is somebody, because, you know, the British Labour Party has a history of deep involvement in imperialist politics. It was the British Labour Party in government that first created a secret nuclear weapons program to create a British nuclear bomb in the 1940s. The British Labour Party was involved in sending British troops into military engagements all over the world during the latter part of the 20th century. Corbyn comes from a different place politically from that traditional Labourite imperialist politics. He has an absolutely admirable and unquestioned track record in standing up for the oppressed. There is no doubt that if Corbyn is elected as the Prime Minister in Britain, it's going to create a crisis in terms of Britain's historic foreign policy, in terms of Britain's involvement with NATO, for example, and in terms of Britain's involvement with other imperialist agencies, prime amongst them, of course, the European Union. He is somebody who appeals directly to masses of people who want a different kind of politics. He appeals to youth. He appeals to people who have suffered from racism. He is somebody with a really dynamic and consistent approach to anti-imperialist politics. So in that sense, he's very unusual in terms of the British political scene. People like that don't come along very often, and when they do, they certainly don't rise to become the leaders of the major party of opposition in British politics.
That's the voice of Alex Gordon. Alex is the former president of the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers. We're talking about these stunning developments inside the UK. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. And all of this happening, John, at the same time, people in the UK must be very, very excited about the World Cup. A couple exciting developments.
And about Donald Trump's upcoming trip to the UK.
John, he's canceling his trip to London. Maybe he'll go elsewhere, but he's afraid to go to London, depriving people in London of a tremendous opportunity for what would be one of the largest mass demonstrations in a long time.
I wish I could be there. Alex, it was great having you. We were joined from London by Alex Gordon, former president of the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back with a lot more.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Mass protests in Haiti. Large-scale protests have taken place in Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti, over the government's decision to raise fuel prices. We're going to talk about these protests, what they mean for Haiti, what they mean for the future. We're joined from Miami by Tim Schwartz. Tim is an anthropologist whose latest book is The Great Haiti Humanitarian Aid Swindle. Tim Schwartz, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you for joining. These are fierce protests. I mean, people are angry. They're in the streets. There's been a lot of frustration, pent-up frustration, I would say, over the continued immiseration of people in Haiti for a long time, the breakdown of traditional state institutions in Haiti. Just describe the situation and what's been the catalyst for the protests?
Well, there were two catalysts. There's the frustration that you talk about. I mean, people were disappointed with the earthquake relief effort, and it's gone now. The money's gone. The United Nations gone, which took away a lot of money, a major source of income for not just the elite who have homes to rent, but also for the poor who benefit at certain level from the economic impetus, the influx of that money from the United Nations. It was a big part of the economy. But there was the triggering mechanism. The Haitians love Brazil. And whenever there's a football game throughout Haiti, wherever you are, it's dead. If there's a Brazilian football game, it's dead silence. And of course, this was the most important game of the year. And you know, it's dead silent because everybody's watching the football game. And you can hear, if Brazil scores, you can hear a cheer go up through the neighborhoods, through Port-au-Prince. And of course, if they lose or if they get scored against, you hear an ah. Anyway, so they lost the game. There was a lot of frustration about that. And the fact that the government had tried to raise the gas prices and then they came out of the football game to learn about that was, it was just a combination of two incidences. Collective disappointment at Brazil losing and anger because Brazil played very well. And then the fact that they were getting one more, it was not just one more. They're raising the gas prices. Everybody understands that as a significant draw on income. It means prices go up. And we've seen this before. We saw this with the rice riots in 2008. We've seen it several times. We saw it with the elections. Population of Port-au-Prince hits a point where they just can't take anymore. And it's difficult for people who don't live in the environment to understand. But when something like this happens, it's not just an increase in income or an extra burden like we would experience in the United States. This is a population that's already at the breaking point. And when you raise the prices, you do a lot more than just make things difficult. You increase thievery. you increase frustration on the streets. I mean, it raises the tension level, insecurity. It raises tension at every level.
That's the voice of Tim Schwartz. We're talking to Tim about the protests that have been raging through Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti, for the last several days after the government announced price increases, especially for fuel. I want to read to you, Tim, how the CNN is playing it. The U.S. Embassy in Haiti warned its citizens Saturday to stay inside and continued demonstrations in the capital of Port-au-Prince and a northern city following a fuel price hike. Protesters have been demonstrating this week against the sharp rise in fuel prices. The prices for gasoline were to rise 38%, while diesel prices were going to go up 47% and kerosene 51%. You know what's interesting, Tim? There's about 100 to 120 American guests who are staying in this Port-au-Prince hotel where demonstrations had taken place. That's the lead story for CNN. It's about these 120 American tourists, about the fact that they're sheltering in place. That's the story. Again, just sort of chauvinistic, I don't know, racist coverage, because it's as if the people in Haiti are simply like sort of a prop for this news story rather than the actual center of the story.
I mean, that's more of, we see that commonly with the media. And that's what people get interested in. They can relate to it. And, you know, it's almost like a movie where the actor has to be a white middle-class American in order for people to go to see it. So, I mean, that's just a byproduct, I think, of the media. But for, you know, to focus on, you know, some of the more significant aspects, the type of things they should be focused on. I mean, one of the amazing things you see with these kinds of riots or, you know, collective frustration explosions is that very few people actually got killed. The violence was directed at property, was directed at the wealthy, and it was, you know, it's sort of fascinating how accurately they attacked specific hotels that were associated with families that people consider part of the repression, the economic repression and monopolization of the economy. And it's amazing, like, for instance, there was one person killed, there were three or four people at least killed that they've reported on, and probably more. But there was one incident that captures the type of violence that you see in these situations in Haiti, where a politician was stopped at a roadblock and the bodyguard got out and started shooting in the air. When he ran out of bullets, the crowd killed the bodyguard. Okay, that's horrifying. But the fact is, he got out of the car and started shooting the gun. And the sort of amazing thing about Haitian mob violence like this is it typically won't hurt anybody as long as there's no aggression from the people. There's some stealing. My wife got robbed. It's frightening, of course. It's you know, you can look in the videos of shoulders burning tires and people running around smashing windows. It's frightening. But again, one of the amazing things that the media should take note of, and those people who are trapped in hotels and panicking and giving interviews about how they're fearing for their life, one thing that people should take note of is that they're not collectively attacking people and hurting people. Not the type of thing that we saw with the LA riots. What you have is the only means of expression for an extremely repressed population. And it's sort of, you know, as an anthropologist, it's sort of a fascinatingly well-controlled chaos or anarchy.
That's Tim Schwartz. We're talking to Tim from Miami. He's an anthropologist. His latest book is The Great Haiti Humanitarian Aid Swindle. Let's talk about the Great Haiti Humanitarian Aid Swindle. There was the terrible earthquake and terrible loss of human life and devastation of Haiti's infrastructure. That was 8 years ago in 2010. Why the Great Haiti Humanitarian Aid Swindle? What is it?
Well, I call it a swindle. I mean, it wasn't deliberate, at least it wasn't conspiratorial, but the point of the word swindle is that a lot of the money collected or sent to Haiti, first of all, it was collected with a lot of exaggerations, a lot of stories about things like mass rape, you know, homicide, you know, unbridled killing, stealing, things that were at the orphans, you know, children separated from their parents and lost. A lot of these were radical exaggerations targeted, they're created by the aid agencies and targeted to increase donations. They make it look very bad, but they did increase in donations. In massive amounts of money, UNICEF collected $291 million help the poor children of Haiti. And they did it. One way that they did it is by feeding the media information about lost and separated children and slave children and perverts prowling the rubble looking for children that they would, you know, kidnap and enslave. These were just radical exaggerations that, that don't reflect the reality in Haiti. Anyway, then the next story about and why I call it a swindle. So there was two levels of swindle is because most of that money went to those organizations and was spent by those organizations on themselves, on more exaggerations, on their own pension plans, their own salaries. And a lot of it, too, was just radically or was just indiscriminately wasted because they spend so much time. And this is sort of the thesis of the book. The aid agencies spent so much time focusing on gathering donations, largely through stories and exaggerations that target sympathies of donors that they don't even understand what the real problems are on the ground. And you've got actually, you know, the exaggerations and this temptation to search for stories to get donors to give has led to, you know, a sort of complete misunderstanding of what's really happening in Haiti.
What about the fact, and I've read a little bit about this in the past, you have all these NGOs functioning and providing core services or pretending to provide core services in some cases. In other words, doing the work of what would normally be state institutions. And some of what I've read is that the Western NGOs from Europe or from the United States have in fact become in a way like a shadow government, but they're really private entities with their own private agendas, their own private budgeting, and without actual oversight. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, of course, that is true. Haiti's, you know, they have a state, at least in name, and they collect their salaries, but functionally the state in Haiti is non-existent. And that's, you know, part of the frustrations is what they manage to do is intercede between the donors, governments that are trying to help, and NGOs and the population and, you know, and give themselves high salaries and the jobs to people who aren't competent. But people are frustrated with the state. And yes, the NGOs are providing the services. And the NGOs are doing a very poor job of it. And for the most part, again, they're disconnected with the reality of Haiti for the most part. They sell stories and subsequently pursue like the fulfillment of those stories, like, you know, 400,000 slave children, which they claim, which isn't true. And they pursue the sort of addressing those issues. And that wastes money. But they're also just terribly inefficient, terribly inefficient.
We're going to leave it there. We've run out of time. We've been joined from Miami by Tim Schwartz. Tim is an anthropologist. His latest book is The Great Haiti Humanitarian Aid Swindle. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, privacy, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined again, as we are every Monday, from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garafa. Chris, welcome back.
Happy Monday, guys. Glad to be back.
Thank you for joining. John Kiriakou, this is an important segment. Chris submits key stories to us on the technology front before this show so that we, you know, we have some sense of where we're going with it. What's jumping out at you?
The thing that I think is most interesting this week is an article that appeared entitled, "Here's How We Found the Names and Addresses of Soldiers and Secret Agents Using a Simple Fitness App." And the reason this was so interesting to me was every once in a while, somebody will stumble on a mistake that the CIA's Office of Central Cover makes. And it's usually an oversight or a dumb mistake, and it has the potential to expose many, many people who are working undercover and in some cases deep cover. A reporter once contacted me and said that he had stumbled on a mistake and he was able to identify more than 36 secret undercover officers at the CIA. I took it upon myself to call the CIA. I was no longer an employee there. And I tipped them off to this, saying, hey, you guys have a problem here. This reporter was able to figure this out with 15 minutes of work. You need to correct this. I hope that they did. But Chris has flagged this article for us, saying, here we are now, years later, where we have apps that everybody has on their phones and that we use as parts of our daily lives. And now these apps are able to out secret agents. Chris, can you tell us about this?
Sure. So this was put out yesterday by De Correspondent, which is a Dutch newspaper. The article is in English if folks want to go see it. But effectively, they're looking at a Strava app, which is a fitness tracker. And it's not the only fitness tracker that's going to be affected by this, we should say. Pretty much all of them are. And they just poked around at a public map that Strava puts out. Anyone can go and see this map. I opened it up myself over the weekend and started poking around. And you can see where people are doing their exercise. So, you know, in the U.S., it's, you know, around major cities and metropolitan areas, as you'd expect of high population centers. But then they scrolled around. And, John, you know, I really thought you'd appreciate this story. They scrolled around and saw that there were some military bases and CIA installments and other top secret facilities where they could see people exercising. The folks that had these public profiles probably didn't realize that they were giving away potentially their name, which could then lead to people finding their home address and other information about them. So these investigative journalists go and they find, they focus on some Dutch sites, because this is a Dutch website. They focus on some Dutch military sites, and they're actually able to very quickly identify four Dutch intelligence service and military employees who were working at very secret, very supposedly very secure locations. So it's a very scary thing, actually, to think about that. Now, if these journalists were able to do it in, you know, a matter of a few hours or days, you know, you have to think about what, you know, what kind of forces would be able to do this if they were really looking to harm people, and also what this would mean for a regular person. One of the things, you know, that scares me about this is that if there's a person who is dealing with, for example, a situation of stalking or domestic violence and doesn't realize that their information is just going to be out there on this map, they could be opening themselves up to some really dangerous consequences without even realizing it.
That's right. And it's not just the danger of being outed. There's a danger of violence. You know, we know from our time in the Iraq war, managing the drone operations there, that a simple off-the-shelf software package that you can buy on Amazon.com can actually bring down a drone. It'll allow you to hack into a military drone and bring it down. Well, this simple app will allow you to track the movements of people who are undercover or military officers, and will tell you exactly where they are, when they're there, the normal routes that they take when they exercise, and this could actually put people in mortal danger.
But it would seem also that, it would seem also now that this is out, and maybe it was known before it was out to the public through, you know, these secondary sort of lay persons, news media organizations, intelligence organizations must know that this is harvestable. And as such, Chris, I mean, it would seem that all the major state intelligence services would be already engaged in this. And again, for instance, if you want to know where U.S. troops are in Syria, because the U.S. is setting up all sorts of clandestine bases, you could just track where people are exercising through this app.
Exactly. You know, it's interesting. When I read this article over the weekend, I immediately, after the first few paragraphs, opened up the public map, and I started kind of just scrolling around the world, and I happened to find, you know, kind of in the middle of nowhere, based on the activity, the country of Mali in Africa, and started looking in and found the military bases in Gao, and then scrolled down through the article, and actually that was what they talked about in the article as well, is these two military installations. They're a UN station. It's mostly German, French, and American soldiers at these, and you can see exactly where at this airport people are doing their runs and walking around. So that's absolutely, you know, this is just really bad. We call it, you know, operational security or OPSEC, exposing this kind of stuff. It's compounded when you realize that people are using their, you know, many people use their real names on this. So you can actually search. There are holes in this system where you can search for somebody's name. You can search for who's been exercising in a certain area and get that information. So some of these holes have been patched and cleared up, but this map is still out there. This map is still public on the Strava site, and you can go in and get it. So there are various serious security concerns, especially for individuals here.
Chris Carafa is our guest. It's Monday, so that means we talk with Chris every Monday in a segment called Technology Rules with Chris Carafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. You can hear this show every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. if you're in the Washington, D.C. area at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com. You can subscribe to Loud and Clear on iHeartRadio and also iTunes Radio. Chris, let's go on to the next big story. Where do you want to go next?
So we should talk about what's going on in London. There's a story in The Verge that talks about how the police chief in London is, quote, completely comfortable, quote, using facial recognition technology, even though that technology, as it's been implemented, has a 98% error rate, meaning that 98% of the time, it's not identifying people or not identifying them properly. The UK has set up cameras, especially in London, all over the place. In the UK, you are effectively under surveillance wherever you go in major cities. It's been a big push by the Metropolitan Police Department in London. It's similar to how if you go to New York City, folks who are familiar with New York City, especially Harlem and the areas that are being gentrified, the police set up literal towers to watch people, except in this case, it's people watching from behind screens in a comfortable office, and it covers much more of the city and is all recorded in real time. So the facial recognition that the Met is using, the Metropolitan Police Department in London, the Met, is just not accurate. And this story in The Verge explains that out of the two correct matches it's made, there have been zero arrests. Because the two people weren't wanted for anything. There was one that was on an out-of-date watch list, and the other was for a person, they say, with mental health issues who frequently contacts public figures. Now, this leads to another issue for the people of London, where why is this person on a list if they're not wanted for arrest and haven't committed any crimes? But on the facial recognition issue, the concern here especially is that we know that facial recognition technology can work. It's not a matter of the idea of the technology doesn't work. It absolutely can work, and it does work in other places and in other applications. And as these systems get smarter and faster and are able to use better cameras, there is a possibility that this system will work. But for now in London, the concern is going to be about profiling. The concern is going to be about people getting picked up for things that they did not do or for mistaken identities. Because at some point, I believe the police are going to want to prove this technology and make some maybe high-profile arrests or detentions to show to reassure the public that this multi-million euro investment is actually going to work.
Chris Carafa is our guest. We're talking about technology rules. Chris, you know, when I'm looking at the, I want to stay with this issue a little bit, John, because the issue of facial recognition is, you know, it's a ubiquitous technology. It's going everywhere.
And it's more and more prevalent.
It's everywhere.
And it's only getting worse.
Yeah. So I'm looking at the front page of the New York Times today. It's a very dramatic photo. I was on the metro today reading the New York Times hard copy, and it was like very dramatically placed on the front page. It's a picture of this crowd of Chinese people inside the People's Republic of China walking towards someplace. They're all walking together as a group. And around the face of each person is a box with a number. And there's not any people in this picture of this big crowd who don't have a box around their face and a number. And it's obviously a picture of facial recognition or a facsimile of a facial recognition instrument. And the headline of the article is, inside China's dystopian dreams, AI, that's artificial intelligence, shame, and lots of cameras. And I want to read the first couple of sentences to you. In the Chinese city of Zhengzhou, a police officer wearing facial recognition glasses spotted a heroin smuggler at a train station. In Qingdao, a city famous for its German colonial heritage, cameras powered by artificial intelligence helped the police snatch 24 criminal suspects in the midst of a big annual beer festival. Then we go down a couple paragraphs. With millions of cameras and billions of lines of code, China is building a high-tech authoritarian future. Beijing is embracing technologies like facial recognition and artificial intelligence to identify and track 1.4 billion people. It wants to assemble a vast and unprecedented national surveillance system with crucial help from its thriving technology industry. Okay, Chris, that sounds pretty bad. That sounds like the all-powerful state, the authoritarian future. Why would this not be, in fact, almost the same as what you're describing in the UK? I mean, if the United States or if the UK media wanted to sound the alarm to their own citizens about the national surveillance state in their own country, they could have the same sort of dramatic headlines and very vivid pictures, or maybe it's, as I said, a photo facsimile. I don't really know. But what's the difference? Why is it an authoritarian state in China, but just like it's all good old British democracy in London?
Yeah, exactly. When I read this morning, I thought this could read Inside London's Dystopian Dreams, because we just read the same story out of London, but it's framed very differently about how the technology may not work. It's got an error rate. I don't know enough about the technology, unfortunately, about what the Chinese government is using, but clearly it seems like it's more advanced than what the UK is using based on this article and a few others that I've come across. And so first, to go back to the London situation, this does show that it's not a matter of facial recognition not working, period. It's a matter of facial recognition technology maybe not being as accurate in some implementations. But to go back to it, it is absolute hypocrisy and part of this anti-China fervor that the U.S. government and other Western governments have been pushing for so many decades now, to call China's implementation dystopian, but not say that NSA spying, the PRISM program, and others are dystopian, or that London's use of cameras on every corner are dystopian. And the other thing I was thinking when I saw this photo, Brian, is that when you look at this, if you upload a photo to Facebook with a whole bunch of your friends in it, it will automatically say, do you want to tag Jim and John and Jane in this photo if they're friends of yours? So Facebook is already doing this as a private corporation with absolutely no government oversight. Facebook has this technology as well. No one's really calling Facebook dystopian in the mass U.S. media, unless they're doing it just for clicks when Mark Zuckerberg testifies in front of Congress. So we really need to be aware of how the media is covering these technology questions. This isn't the only situation where China is being called out for something that is either common practice or that the U.S. is doing, or doing to an even greater extent. There was a story this morning where China is making their own processors. They're using technology to make their own processors. And many of the analyses that I'm reading of this are saying, well, what if China puts spy technology in their processors? Well, it's already known that the NSA and CIA sometimes intercept devices, especially networking devices, to put their own spy gear, their own spy chips into these devices while they're being shipped to a customer. So why aren't we talking about that as a dystopian fear? Why is it only about China? And again, it's because the U.S. government, the Western capitalist governments, want to keep China in its place and stoke this great fear of China as a world economic and political power.
Yeah, and I want to go back again. I think that, because part of what we're doing here also on Loud and Clear is we try to analyze the media and how the media treats things and forms and helps form public opinion, shapes public opinion. Obviously, the issue of facial recognition, artificial intelligence, in the hands of Apple, in the hands of Facebook, in the hands of Google. It's treated as more or less a benign technology. Maybe there's a few wrinkles that have to be ironed out, but basically good. The language is never employed about authoritarianism. And again, I want to read this New York Times article about China's use of facial recognition. China's new surveillance is based on an old idea. Only strong authority can bring order to a turbulent country. And then, ironically, the writer of the New York Times article says Mao took that philosophy to devastating ends, including the Cultural Revolution. Well, you can't actually call the Cultural Revolution, a top-down rule, since Mao had encouraged young people to rebel against the Communist Party of China and the government. Anyway, that's an aside. His successors, I'm going to continue with the article, because just think, if we were writing the same article, would it be applicable to the UK? Would it be applicable to the United States? His successors also craved order, but feared the consequences of totalitarian rule. They formed a new understanding with the Chinese people. In exchange for political impotence, they would be mostly left alone and allowed to get rich. It worked. Censorship and police powers remained strong, but China's people still found more freedom. The new attitude helped usher in decades of breakneck economic growth. Today, that unwritten agreement is breaking down. China's economy isn't growing at the same pace. It suffers from a severe wealth gap. Again, think about, could this be applicable to the United States and the UK? After four decades of fatter paychecks and better living, its people have higher expectations, and thus the need, according to the New York Times article, to set up this dystopian society where the state knows everything, tracks people, knows their every move. Again, these are completely applicable terms or scenarios to Western countries, including our own country, including the United States. But the language of authoritarianism, the sounding of the alarm of the dangers inherent in this kind of system, completely absent. It's just never, you don't see it in the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal about any Western government.
This is the real danger, because a true loss of civil liberties comes incrementally. And usually we gladly give them up because of some perceived threat or some perceived danger. And the next thing we know, our government is spying on us. We see that every day here, whether it's the revelations that we received from Ed Snowden or the Vault 7 revelations or articles like this, talking about facial recognition and cameras everywhere. People should be in the streets over this.
And indeed, that's exactly right. And again, it's one thing for the media that shapes public opinion in the West to allow us to hate the surveillance systems in China, but think of the surveillance systems in our own lives as something benign, something protective, in fact, better than benign, something good. Anyway, Chris, let's go on with some of the other stories. You know, this isn't on your story list, and I know John will get back to some of the other stories, but I just wanted to ask you real quick. I was looking at Wired magazine this morning, and they were talking about the 10 worst cybersecurity breaches of 2018 so far. Not coincidentally, it appears half of them are somehow related to Russia. But here's one. Under Armour. Hackers breached Under Armour's MyFitnessPal app in late February, compromising usernames, email addresses, and passwords from the app's roughly 150 million users. The company discovered the intrusion on March 25th and disclosed it under a week. Some welcome hustle from a large company. But 150 million app users? And again, how common is this kind of a breach, and how big of a deal is it for individuals?
You know, this actually goes back to the first story we talked about. Under Armour is the MyFitnessPal is in nutrition and health and exercise tracking system. So it's actually very similar to what we talked about in the first segment. And this can be, again, very scary for people who are trying to lose weight, trying to take care of themselves, you know, whatever it is, that are all of a sudden their personal data is out there and in the hands of hackers or potentially released to the public. And that's a very big violation of privacy. These hacks, these data breaches, these leaks, they're happening more and more often. And it's very difficult, in fact, to keep up with how often they're happening and what the depth of them is. Because in many cases, not in the Under Armour case, but in many cases, companies can wait weeks or months before saying anything about them. And then they underestimate or understate the how many people were affected. You know, there was just a story a couple of weeks ago that a company called Exactus had 340 million records exposed. That's almost the same number of people that live in the United States. It was more than the Equifax breach, and Exactus is a small company that tracks much of our personal, financial, and other private data about us, our credit scores, things like that. I guarantee that almost none of your listeners have ever heard of this firm, Exactus. I hadn't before I saw that story a couple weeks ago. So these breaches are coming up faster and more often because the companies are not spending the money until they're forced to for PR reasons on security. They're forcing these products to go out faster. They're trying to get the product out the door, and they're not paying enough attention to security. And that's a huge problem. And engineers have a responsibility to do their own, to do security audits, and these companies need to have a responsibility when these breaches do happen.
You know, I was going to ask you that question, actually. Why is it that companies are always reactive rather than proactive, and we find them having to announce these major data breaches? They issue apologies. In some cases, they pay for credit card monitoring when credit card numbers are compromised. Why is it that they're not very good, frankly, at preventing these kinds of breaches? It seems to me that if you are worried, if you're the CEO of a company or the CIO of a company, and you're worried about hackers, you should be hiring hackers in order to buffet your system to better protect it.
There are firms. They're called white hat hacking firms, and they do all sorts of this security testing and all of that. Unfortunately, the CEOs and the CIOs and the executives are looking at it this way, John. It's a question of profit. Is it going to cost them more to respond to a breach and provide, you know, free credit monitoring services or, you know, whatever they're going to provide? Or is it going to cost them more to implement good security? That's ultimately and literally the bottom line. They're looking at it as a money question, not a security question.
Chris, we have less than 5 minutes left. There is one substantive issue I want to raise, and then I want to turn to your tech tip, which is really important this week, as it was last week. But first, let's talk about DNA testing. You know, it's such a big story that these immigrant children have been separated from their parents. We know that it's an administrative nightmare. We hear these horror stories about the government just simply not knowing where so many of the children are. Parents are being forced to pay money to be reunited with their kids. But there's an article at The Intercept that's entitled DNA testing might help reunite families separated by Trump, but it could be a privacy nightmare. Why would it be a privacy nightmare?
Yeah, I really appreciated this article in The Intercept talking about why this is going to be such an issue. So first of all, a bunch of companies like MyHeritage and people may have heard of 23andMe have offered to send free DNA testing kits to immigrant aid groups in Texas and around the country to help reunite the children with their families, which sounds fantastic. The problem is, to quote Jennifer Falcon, who works for RACES, one of the groups in Texas that's doing some really amazing work on this issue, quote, these are already vulnerable communities, and this would potentially put their information at risk with the very people defending them. And so we really need to consider what that means, right? If, let's say, your DNA or the DNA of a child is linked to your DNA, and you are not in the U.S., you're not documented to be in the U.S., does that mean that ICE or another agency is going to come and pick you up at home? Or if you go to pick up a child that you've been matched to, and there have been cases of this happening where somebody goes to pick up a child or a relative from a detention center and they themselves are arrested, this will just widen that. Absolutely.
Yeah, that kind of thing happens. We've got a couple of minutes left and we want to talk about browsers. And there are so many of them out there. People even use multiple browsers. But which one is the best? Is there such a thing as the best browser and why?
So, for the vast majority of cases, I would suggest using Firefox. You can go to getfirefox.com to install it. It's available for Mac and Windows. You can get it on your iPhone, your Android phone. The reason I suggest Firefox is that the company or the organization behind it, Mozilla, is not a for-profit corporation. It's out there to, and they pride themselves on protecting privacy. Mozilla is out there to make what they believe is the best browser. I think it's great. It's fast. It supports all the latest cool stuff on the internet. But they care about your privacy. It's an open source web browser, which means that anyone can go and download the source code behind it and audit it and look and make sure it's not doing anything tricky like sending your information to Google or Apple or anyone else. So that's why I love Firefox. But I want to just suggest people install Firefox and then install a couple add-ons to it to even be better about security. There's an ad blocker called uBlock Origin, the letter U, Block Origin, that just blocks ads and some trackers. And then there's something called Privacy Badger from the EFF, as well as something called HTTPS Everywhere, also from the EFF. And those will also increase the security of your browsing sessions. So I highly recommend people who try to switch over to Firefox for everything you're doing and on your computer, install those add-ons as well so that you have even more security in your browsing session.
Excellent. And that's exactly what we have to do. Well, that was the voice of Chris Garaffa. Chris joined us from New Haven, Connecticut, where he is a web developer and a technologist. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.